Assalamu alaikum. You're listening to She Speaks Academic Muslima. Today our guest is Sara Abdullah, who's the director of design brand Cape to Cairo Collective, a handcrafted eco-conscious contemporary design reflecting the cultural heritage of North Africa. Sara also founded the creative visionary studios Art for Social Change in 2010 that provides access to arts and crafts workshop for marginalized and underrepresented youth in London. She's a multidisciplinary Scottish-Egyptian mural artist, maker, activist, and teacher. She has done her postgraduate work at the University of Strathclyde, Scotland. She'll be joining the doctoral program at University of Middlesex in fall 2022 with a focus on producing murals, agency, and the significance and meaning of community participation in public space. Or more specifically, looking at the question, can murals make the world a better place? Before we get started, I just want to remind you, please subscribe to the podcast and share it with your friends and family and leave a review and do whatever you can to support it. Thank you so much. Assalamu alaikum, Sara.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Hello.
Hey, thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I'm going to launch right into it just so that we can get to the crux of things. I wanted to talk about something that I know exists a lot in the circles I hang out with, and I wanted to know if you've had similar experiences. You know, one of my sisters was very artistically inclined. I mean, she still is very artistically inclined. And my parents were always very worried about her prospect of making a living in terms of like just survival and their fear of, you know, her survival in the world. Have you had similar encounters where people are like, art, you know, how are you going to live off of that? I don't want my kid going into that. What do you say to people like my parents who might be worried about that particular aspect of life?
I can understand it because when your parents have come from hardship, when they are migrants and come to the West for a better life, and their values are very much connected to the history of colonialism, then their preference would be academia, in the sense a profession like law or medicine, finance. I would say that one of my parents was more inclined to me being an artist and continuing with my historical family background in the arts, and I was free to express and to engage and to explore. But on the other hand, a lot of people in my family would say things like, exactly, how are you going to get a job? There's not much work out there. And it's also to do with, I hate to say it, but it's cultural, and it's in some ways, it's materialistic to try to guide your children, and you try to put them on the right path, particularly when it comes to literacy, math, exams. But at the same time, their mental health is really important, and they'll grow up one day and they might feel resentment because a lot of guilt is put on them to follow a certain academic path or to do a particular job in life. And it's also to do with, unfortunately, showing off to the family that we've made it.
That's so true.
I don't want to criticize, but I know that it happens. And it's something that, as I've grown older, I've had my own journey into Islam. So my parents were not particularly pushing me in any one direction. I was raised as a Muslim, you know, the basics, alhamdulillah. But when I realized that it was like a huge eye-opener, like Allah provides, and it's written, kulu maktub. And even though I come from an Arabic-speaking background, my parents moved to Scotland when I was very young, like 3 months old. But they were different to other migrants. So they were economic migrants, and they went to a place where there were no other Egyptians. So we were really thrown into the deep end.
Right.
So we had to immerse and conform and keep our heads down, because it was a very working class area that we went to. So just going back to the ideas of, you know, the directions that I was allowed to take, I was left quite free to go on and make my own choices. I'm glad that I was able to do that because when you choose something that you feel passionately about, you'll do it for the rest of your life. You'll find a way of making a living, and also hopefully it makes meaning to other people's lives, and you can hopefully also, inshallah, better the world in some way.
Definitely.
So that's what I would say to any young person or parents. And you can always do another degree if you want to. You can, like a lot of people that I know that were put a lot of pressure to be academic, did law or medicine. They're now exploring their creative side. So they're like art on the side or making craft and trying to sell it online. The world has changed, since we were young.
Definitely. I definitely know artistically inclined people who did the degree that their parents wanted to do, but then pursued whatever that they wanted to once they had the ability to do so. But a couple of things spoke to me. One is I 100% agree that there's definite respectability politics, this idea of like, we've made it, our kid made it, he or she became a doctor or whatever it is. And that kind of drives. And then there's obviously the survival aspect. But the aspect that I wanted to focus on in your answer is you mentioned the colonization of art and like the colonized thinking as well. I wanted to ask you, like, what are some of the things that like artists that who have the training and the pedigree, especially in a European context, what are they missing from the picture? Are there things they do not realize when it comes to the importance of access of arts for marginalized communities or marginalized youth?
I'll take the point of view. So, for example, when I was studying at art school almost 20 years ago, it was very focused on Western art, contemporary art, identity, but from a white female gaze. And that was because it was second generation of feminism. But what it was is it was this laddish culture of rather than how we express ourselves, maybe as women and being a woman, we were sort of commentating on what it would be like to be a man. It's very difficult because so a lot of the artists that I can think of, that I grew up with in my art school, like Tracy Emin and Damien Hirst, they were very much talking, their stories were from a very white working class perspective, and a lot of the subjects that they touched upon were quite graphic and quite controversial. And then you have the male designers and the male artists who were focusing on materialism. So you would have artists focusing on creating a whole skull just filled with jewels and diamonds. But it was about the exploration that anything goes. You can talk and you can express yourself. You can present what you want or represent what you want. But there were no black and ethnic minority artists around in my time that were actually doing and being successful in the limelight. And that's probably because the democratization of art, which is happening today, because it's quite an elite subject. Many people who are at my art school, their parents were artists, so and their parents were in the art world, so it was through recommendation. It was quite bourgeoisie, very middle class. So they were sort of, they had a pedigree, yes, they were bred for this, and they had connections, and they were grew up going to art galleries and be going to concerts, and a lot of them went to private school,
Right.
grammar schools. So when a lot of people get in on talent, I won't say they don't, but the majority get in because they've been groomed to do this since they were very young. So it's part of their cultural repertoire. So when I decided to apply to art school in London, sometimes it's better to just be naive and not to know all of these things. I found out everything later.
Yes.
And beyond when I went off to do a postgrad and a university in London. But I was very much a na very natural. I just made work that made meaning to me. But it was about my identity. And also what was coming out was, although I come from a Muslim and Middle Eastern North African background, what my landscape was white working class. That's who I went to school with. So my stories, although I was telling my story about how, for example, I was feeling in my area or in my school, in my day-to-day life as a young person, I would present that, or actually through photography, but it would never be me in those photographs. For some reason, when I look back at the work, it was the little white boy who was like my neighbor, who was at school, who was also very disenfranchised, you know, being bullied or being made fun of because he couldn't read, picked on because of the clothes that he was wearing, or he's not got the right trainers on, you know.
Right.
So that was my earlier work. So I've always had a sort of social research. I've always been interested in people's stories and what was going on around me and telling those stories. But when I was doing it, it was before social media, it was before Facebook and Instagram and recording and posting, and people weren't really caring so much about those stories. Not like today where everybody wants to tell their story. Everyone wants to, that has a narrative and wants to share their voice and have a platform. But to me, that was important because when you're an artist, you make work about what you know or what you see. So a lot of my work didn't have any sort of Middle Eastern or Islamic context.
Right, because that's not, that was not the context you were living in.
But on the other hand, you know, it was subversive because although I was telling the story about that little boy, it was me I was talking about,
right.
But rather than representing myself, I would use someone else's image. So it was like, it's sort of interconnected, intersectioning. Although we come from different worlds. So this is, this intertextuality of, we come from different worlds. He's white, he's working class. You expect him to have a, you know, much easier time than someone who's brown with Afro hair and, you know, whose parents are like Muslim, you know, and who just looks different. Actually, we can see that there are some things, the suffering is still there. And that was, the earlier work.
So in that sense, I mean, I think what the powerful thing is that the art connects people and you can see your stories reflected in other people. And even though on the surface, it looks like two completely different people, but the experiences are, you said, they're interconnected. And then the other aspect that I really love is the fact that by telling off your experiences, you are making art then more accessible. Then art can speak to people like me who it may not have spoken to before because I didn't see me or my experiences reflected. And in this way, it speaks to the world that I'm familiar with as well. So that's super powerful to me. And I'm assuming that this kind of connects into why you shifted from industry to activism.
Do you know what the funny thing is? When I started at design school, there were just very simple categories like graphic design, visual based media, illustration, advertising, printmaking, videography. So you would go into one of those departments. But today, what is so exciting is sort of the way I have always thought. So I was sort of, I don't want to say ahead of my time, but I was thinking always multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary, like working with different departments. Oh, I could go and work with someone at this college, you know, that does sociology, or, you know, I can go downstairs to the metal workroom. And so I always have, like I said, I've always sort of been an activist, which means that I've always touched upon telling stories and bringing out what I hope is the truth through research. I've always been interested in researching and really understanding people. That's probably what it is. So when I was at art school, that wasn't really the vogue. It was very much about industry, contextualizing everything and doing things that are, for example, typographical or for a newspaper, magazine covers, advertising. And in a sense, I had to do that to pass. So even though you think that you go to art school and it's very free and you can do whatever you want in design school, that's not how it is. There's a culture and there's also trends, movements that happen. So for example, if people are talking about advertising and there are certain brands out there, then you should be targeted to try to work with those brands or come up with briefs they would attract those brands.
Yeah.
So my work was, I came under, even though I did very well when it comes to, like you were saying, industry, and I won a lot of competitions. I don't think I would have won those if I hadn't have been anonymous.
Oh, wow.
So I wasn't like the cool kid or anything. Like everyone knew how I was, but I was very unassuming. Like, you would never think that out of all of those students, there would be me that won that competition or that client, which I love that, because today it's all about the way you look. It always has been, your image. But this was like, you put your work up there, you just sort of have a number and they go that one. And then they know who you are. And then that's when the process, okay, so that's the first process. Like, okay, so we want you to develop it. But always, whatever work I've done has come from the heart, has come from me, has come from asking questions and researching that particular topic right through and through. So, for example, and a lot of the things I was exposed to was high culture, high income. I mean, I came from Glasgow, came down with a portfolio, and I took it to the art school. I got my interview, and I saw people with portraits, with framed, you know, and I'm coming with my, you know, my piece of sugar paper with like sort of collage and mixed media. And I was thinking, well, they chose me, but why didn't they choose them? But I think, you know, only now do you realize when you're much older, well, it's because when you're looking at someone's work, you want it to be fresh and you just want it to be true. And you want it to be pure, and you don't want to, you want to hear their voice. What are they actually saying? What is the message? Because we're all looking for that message, you know, that
definitely.
We're all looking for, before I used to say, the meaning of life, you know, what does it mean? You know, I'm making sense of it all. So when I did something for the Royal Festival Hall, I'd never been to a live music concert. I'd never been to the South Bank, you know, it's very prestigious. I'd never sat and listened to musicians and had access to that. It's not because my parents are, this is the thing, when your parents have come from another country, they probably were very middle class, very middle to upper in their country.
Yeah.
Of origin. But you know, and as we know now, when we see the conflicts that happen today, they've had to, people who are doctors, they've had to take a huge drop when they've migrated to a new land and start from nothing.
Yeah.
And that's sort of that survival. That's what my parents had to do. They had to go and work. They had to get the jobs. They had to go to work. There was no benefit system for them. So the first 6 or 7 years of my life was spent in Glasgow, and I never traveled to Egypt. So I didn't really, I knew I was different because it's others that make you feel othered. Okay. But I only got access to say these things because when I came to Egypt and spent time with my family and realized, oh, I have a grandfather who's like quite a well-known musician, or my aunt's an artist. But before then, I had no idea. So growing up, and then I would come for holiday to Egypt, then go back to Glasgow, and it would just be really depressing and dull and grey. And you know, I couldn't really be myself. And, you know, I didn't have access to the arts. I didn't have access to galleries and libraries because my parents, although they really wanted that for me, they didn't have time to take me, you
right.
know, when they're working so hard. You know, I'm in nursery and then I'm in school and then, you know, I'm in after school care because they're trying to survive. They're trying to keep me safe. People think, what does that actually mean? And like when people talk about it today, especially when it comes to talking about Black and ethnic minorities and talking about rights, our rights, and also about injustices, what it means is when you're a migrant and you come to another country, it is about staying alive, staying out of trouble, not looking anybody in the eye because you're different, you know, not answering back. You can't, you speak the language, but you have an accent.
Yeah, you don't want to stand out. You don't want to seem too out of place. And I think like something that you just said, I mean, I think it definitely goes, it's more magnified perhaps for artists, but I even sometimes see it in academia that not just simply about your ideas and what you put forth, but your entire brand is what you have to put forth. And it's very exhausting after a certain time, because you have to put in the work for the work, and then you have to develop the brand for who you are. And yeah, I mean, I can imagine how exhausting that might be for somebody who just wants to do like good original work that speaks to them. And then they have to think, okay, now how do I project myself to an audience and make myself more palatable and make myself stand out and look good and so on and so forth. So it's definitely a lot of work. And I think unless you've done some soul searching, it can be a difficult journey. Speaking of soul searching, I wanted to ask you, what intersections, if any, do you see between like faith, Islam in particular, or faith in general, and then art, designing, creating those as forms of expression?
Well, a lot, actually. When I started to find out about Islam for myself, so delve deeper into the big question, you know, in my 30s was like, no, late 20s, what is the meaning of life? Why am I here? Some people think you're raised Muslim, you should know. You know, what do you mean? But you know, the Islam is not something, it's supposed to be, it's for everyone and it's all encompassing, and there's no race and there's no superiority apart from Allah. He's the all-seeing, all-knowing. And I suppose that was where it started, really, this whole, when I kept going back to, I have family who wear the hijab, or we know what Ramadan is, but you know, we might not fast. You see, something that has to be a journey that comes from you, the truth. It's not, what's happened is, I think a lot culture again, is that it's just about showing off in front of people. How many prayers have you done? Have you done the extra? Have you given sadaqah?
Quite a few parallels to art. Art in the sense that, like, you know, it's just as much as about doing the deeds as it is about showing that you did the deeds and, you know.
Rituals, the ritualistic aspect. So the reason I've talked about this is because I had to sort of become, you know how they say born again Christian? I understand what that means. You have to really understand what Islam is for yourself. It's your own journey. It has to come really from deep, deep within. Otherwise, it just becomes rituals and habits. You know, it has to, you have to really feel it. So when I started to think about what it meant, then I started to think of the Islamic world. What is that? Well, when you grow up, you think it's just the Middle East and Arabic speaking people, but it's not, you know, and that's the ignorance to do with how we don't understand that Islam is all over the world. African Muslims, Chinese Muslims, you have Muslims who are up in the highlands, born into Islam or reverts, which that was what opened my eyes. I was like, wow. It was someone who said to me, I have come to Islam. I wasn't born a Muslim. I thought, what? My God, I was born a Muslim? What does that mean? She's like, I took my shahada. I was like, even though my parents speak Arabic, I wasn't raised with the Arabic language. So I didn't speak Arabic at home. Another survival tactic is like, you know, I have to speak English and, you know, go into school and speak in English. And because I didn't have any family, it was just us. Then I started to explore, what does the Muslim world mean? So she was like, she was Turkish. And then I started to go to the mosque. And then I started going to some talks. And then I met so many Muslims from Jamaica, from West Africa, Nigeria. And I was like, wow, you know, we have a lot of ignorance still today in our countries, in the Middle East, in Asia, you know, saying racism, that Islam is for the Arab, Islam
is for Pakistanis, all of this,
or for Indians, or, you know, that we're all just brown, you know, it's just like.
And did all of this impact your perception of art or your practice of art, like recognizing the diversity within Islam?
Yeah, because I've always been interested in people. So that was the missing link. It was like, I know that there's something missing that I don't know. Sorry, I feel quite emotional. Because I'm like, these are my brothers and sisters. These are my people. And my people is actually global. It's everybody. The difference is what makes us unique and special. And Islam is about the oneness of Allah. And then when you realize, it's when they say it's about submission to Allah and worshipping Him only, you're His slave. Some people, they actually can't fathom that. They find that very difficult because we're born to be straight and be proud, you know.
Right.
How can I bend down to someone? How can I bow down, put my head right down? That was it. That was like, subhanAllah, they say that, you know, Allah moves you, he's the one, you don't leave him, he leaves you. These things that I started to really delve into, I think like my family were quite surprised because they were just like, okay. Like, you know, when you really get into something, that's the thing. It's like research. It's like when you do a PhD, it's like you're just really into it. You just immerse yourself. It's almost like an obsession, you know?
Right.
So, and you know, my parents grew up in like the 60s and 70s, you know, in the Middle East. So that was like very free time. It was very liberal and, you know, not many people or hijab at all, you know, and that's something else to do. The story goes, you know, political Islam, and you know, a lot of people know how that happened
Right.
afterwards. And there's nothing wrong. You wear the hijab, you don't wear the hijab, it's your own choice. But I think people are surprised because I didn't wear the hijab until 5 years ago. But that was a personal choice. But I think it's probably they were like the last person that they needs to think.
Yeah.
She's prays five times a day or whatever that is. She fasts and, you know, she tries to eat halal, you know. But I think like the intersectioning is that after that, I traveled more. So before I traveled Western Europe a lot, I traveled to America. But then I was like, oh my gosh, I need to go to Andalusia,
Yeah.
Spain, 900 years of Islamic rule.
Oh.
That is, you know, they don't tell you that on the TV.
So
They don't
basically
put that in
the
public
more,
broadcast.
yeah, the more stories you got to know, the broader your conception of art gets. And speaking of broad conceptions of art, graffiti in general, murals on walls, what is the significance of that form of art, especially in comparison to something that's considered more highbrow art, like in a gallery and stuff like that? What drew you to graffiti and, you know, wall paintings, wall murals and stuff?
It is about a legacy. It's about saying when you grow old, or if you were to die tomorrow, what have I done with my life? What good have I actually done? What message have I actually put out there that has changed anyone's life or made meaning? It's all about making meaning, I suppose. And about 11 years ago, well, a little bit before that, when we had the economic crash, 2008, I think it was, and people were going bankrupt, people were losing their house, mortgages were being defaulted. It was the first time I'd ever really understood my place on the planet.
Wow.
And I think a lot of people, because that was in the news, so that was the information that a lot of us didn't know about capitalism, that big word that just kept coming up. You know, you think that
Yeah.
academics speak about that, but that's written in books and libraries. But the ordinary person began to see the truth. What's
Yeah.
a loan? People were losing money and they were losing their jobs. And then I thought, you know, Sarah, your work has always been about telling, you know, stories about underrepresented or marginalized people. And right now, there's just so much talk and there's just so many people around the table debating and speaking about them up there and, you know, the rich and the poor and trying to put the world to rights like we all do. Then came the Arab Spring. And it's funny, like I said, you know, you're part of the diaspora, but you've never really lived you've never lived in your parents' country, but you've heard so much about it. But you don't need to actually live in that part of the world to empathize with whatever's going on. But it just
Right.
so happened. The Arab Spring was happening in my parents' region. So, and it was like, I don't want to say this, but I don't believe in magic. But it was like a magical, it was like an atmosphere that was just rushing like a wave around the world of
Yeah.
protest.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, people were just taken to the streets. And whether it was to do with the bank, Occupy, the banks occupying space, you know, it was like, we can do this. It's
Yeah.
not them plus, there's not a barrier. You know,
Right.
we can go there, but
Like
it
public
has to.
space itself was very accessible.
Yeah.
Public space was being used as a form of resistance.
It wasn't just that it was accessible. It's always been accessible, you know, like Times Square. Well, it was to do with the masses, the zeitgeist. Something just happened where everybody just said, this enough is enough.
Right.
So it was the elite. It was academics. It was people from the streets. It was students. It was parents who would tell you, don't go out in the street. Oh my gosh, never protest. Don't get political. We're all told that. But
Right.
this, no, we have to go out. So I think that was it for me. My work just became, rather than, like I said, it was about representation, identity, agency, telling stories. My thing was now participatory. We are a community. Now we talk about a global village, but back then that wasn't the word. We didn't have that word, but we started to see how small the world was.
Yeah.
Like, because of the story and the narrative that was emerging and seeing people, what was happening to them. So then I decided, look, and it was a really interesting period because even though so many things were happening in the Arab Spring, at that time, what had happened in Egypt and stuff, what was emerging from that, and before that, what had happened was there was so much anger with that one incident that happened to that street seller.
Yes, the person who set himself on fire out of frustration.
Yes. He's just an ordinary man, you know, but it just brought so much terror to people. They're just like,
they could feel his frustration. They could feel his desperation.
Yeah, I don't know him, you know, and you don't have to be a political person. It's not that I'm saying I'm on this side or that side. It's just being human.
Right.
And also someone might say, oh, you feel that way because you're Muslim. You feel that way because your parents are from that side of the world. No. And that's the thing we have to be careful with when it comes to this categorizing, putting ourselves into little categories, and especially when it comes to identity, because then what happens is they divide us again. So what was beautiful about that period is that we were all together, taken to the streets. And then what had happened was, I remember we'd have, like, you know, at that time, people were meeting up in cafes, they were sitting on the street, they were just having conversations, people, bankers, lawyers, doctors, these, like I said, the people who are seen as quite elite, they would join in after work and they would come and they would make their placards, and there were people making food vans set up, businesses were trying to help people who were protesting, the protesters. And it was really a call to arms, you know, they were making placards. So that was when you started to see, like, visual sort of reality and it was quite makeshift, you know. It was very the sense of urgency, we just need to get it down,
right?
And it was like stripping us bare, you know. And that was it was a time where people weren't really that bothered about, like, consumerism and capitalism for a while. It was like a little bubble.
Yeah.
So then I was like, okay, we're doing all this and we're talking. And I remember being in Cairo at the time when the protests were happening, and I saw so much art coming out, a lot of response, graffiti art, beautiful artwork, but also work that was very sad and deeply distressing.
Right.
You know, some stories that were coming out. So, you know, I was just thinking, it just clicked. I thought, everybody wants to say something. Like, everybody wants to be heard. So I thought, but then someone said to me, ha, 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 you're sitting, all you do is talk, but where's the action? What are you actually doing to change? You're all just chatting. It just became like from doing something to like what they start to say about us as protesters or resistance.
Right.
Oh, you're just lazy, just lay about, just chatting. What are you actually doing?
Make a difference. Yes.
So I thought, So then someone said to me, revolution, I've seen it before, I've seen resistance, nothing ever changes. So I thought, oh, revolution. Then I was like, it's so British, but I was like, oh, why bother? You know, I was like, who cares? Like, so then I just came up with this title. And then I thought, I don't want to be the only one making the work. I don't just want to be the producer.
Right.
You know, and the reader, producer-reader relationship. I produce, you read, you take your readings from it. You know, what does it signify? What signs do you see? What meanings do you make? You know, that whole social anthropological idea. So I thought, no, I was loving being part of a community, and I was really enjoying the discourse, the conversations that were coming out. So why don't I, because I'm an artist, represent that? How would I do that? And I thought, just get people to come up and talk about how they're feeling on this wall, but not just scribbles. Has to look nice. It has to have a very deep message, and it's giving them your agency to put down how they feel. And it was, the question was, what would you do to make a better world? It's very simple, but
Yeah.
everyone's always wondering, how do I better this world? What can I do?
That's a beautiful question. You know, no matter what station of life you're at, what journey you're on, you know, it's something that can speak to everybody. Given that you've been so involved in, you know, giving other people this platform, this accessibility to art, giving people access to murals and graffiti, why, I mean, and I ask this as somebody who's, you know, knee deep in academia, and I find sometimes it quite frustrating. Why pursue academia? Coming from such a place of artistic freedom, why pursue academia?
Because it's needed. Because there's still academia. Decolonizing academia is very important.
Right.
Most people who reach academia are white middle class.
Definitely.
Or they've come from, and people say, oh, but I see a lot of black and brown faces. Yeah, because you know them personally, right?
Yeah.
But if you look around your college, how many old professors there are. We need to understand how powerful art actually is when it comes to talking about serious issues, and how it can actually get the message across, maybe better visually than through literacy, through the written word in some ways. You know, it's accessible.
Yeah.
And also, like academia, you know, I have this funny relationship with it, because I feel like my early years at school, when I was a little girl, if I was just treated a little bit better by my teachers, given a bit more time and understanding, then I probably would have done my PhD when I was, now this is very personal, but, and it's taken me a long time to be able to say this, but I probably would have done it much earlier in my life, because I've always been interested in research.
Yeah.
People say, why do you want to do a PhD? It doesn't matter what the word is, you know, it's just a label. Like, if it wasn't a rose, it would still smell like a rose, that sort of
yeah.
description.
Yeah.
It's just always been interested in research and
yes.
finding out the answers, and also had a big, the questions, yeah, and trying to come up with original thoughts and truth.
This definitely resonates.
Teachers are very important. If you send your child to school, they're the ones, apart from at home, if you're lucky enough to have a stay-at-home mom or someone who works part-time, or your parents are very much involved, you know, in your confidence building. This is another side to me talking about education. What does that actually mean? Life is big and it's short. You know, you think, I'll send my kid to school and I'll make sure they read all the right books and they're doing all their homework and they've got lots of ticks. But then it's also, well, how do they feel inside? How are they being treated? Is the teacher raising them and lifting them up? Is she pushing them? Is she helping them? And a lot of the problems do come in school from sometimes teachers, especially in the past, which we've learned from, especially during the Windrush generation, and that people of colour have not actually been treated very well, not by just by the pupils, but by the teachers.
Definitely. And that shifts the trajectory of our lives and what we end up pursuing and what we feel free to pursue and explore, because we think our art isn't up to par. Our art is not real art. It's just cultural scribblings of sorts. But only when they see a diversity of expression in academia like yours, can our kids have that opportunity. So I 100% applaud you for taking on this journey, because it's a difficult journey, but it's a much needed journey.
Definitely. I mean, I'm struggling. You know, it's taken me I've been thinking about doing, I mean, a PhD is a body of work, a body of research, you know, something that you pursue. I've been doing this for 10 years. It's been consistent. You know, I've gone around and we've put walls in so many places. We've had so many participants. You know, it's been in galleries, it's been on the streets. But because of my own, again, and I hope this will help other people, young people, whoever's listening, you are not defined by what happened to you when you were young, but it stays with you. People don't realize, parents, teachers, a word, a treatment, it can stay with a person It can drive you, like they say, it can drive you and it can push you for success, but it can also distort your view of yourself and your achievements because, like you say, academia is quite elite. And people think that, you know, to do a PhD, not many people from poor backgrounds or backgrounds which have had a lot of adversity reach that level because lots of factors, right? And there's a lot of people of color who, especially from certain backgrounds, more the majority have managed to reach that. And it's because their parents were successful. They had businesses, they had time to send them and have tutors or go to private school. Okay, it's still a very unfair playing field in so many ways to get up there because to be able to do something like a PhD, you have to be able to articulate, you have to be able to write. It's still that sequence of writing, that trajectory, putting where the full stop goes in the comma, and also about your voice, and also about referencing and about reading, a lot of reading. That's why my work is very much geared, and the people that I want to work with and to help are people who have never really had those chances. The young people that I work with or I approach, they don't read books because there's not a culture at home of reading a book. They've started off on an unfair playing field, or they've come from another land where their parents don't speak English. So they're just getting by at school. There's no one there to do the homework with them.
I truly, truly appreciate like the fact that you're on this journey, that you're persevering through this journey. But most of all, I really appreciate how you've opened the doors for so many to whom art is not the most accessible medium of expression, and bringing the value of art into the lives of those who could not have made use of that value prior, or did not see that value prior. So I really do appreciate the work that you're doing. And I really appreciate you coming on the podcast and discussing all of this.
It's been lovely to speak to you, and it's been real cathartic as well. I mean, it's very hard to talk about being personal, you know, but the work, everything you do is personal, actually.
Everything, yes. Personal is political. Yes, definitely. I 100% agree. Well, thank you so much, Sarah, though. Thank you so much for coming on and discussing all of this and laying bare all the difficulties of the journey as well.
Bless you. Thank you so much for having me. It's just been a real pleasure to speak to you today. And I hope our paths cross again, inshallah.
Inshallah, inshallah. Assalamu
Alaikum salam. Bye-bye.
alaikum. Bye.
But before we get started, I just want to remind you, please subscribe to the podcast, spread it amongst your friends and family. Spread it? No, don't spread it.